Good morning, everyone. I think we all know that this is a very auspicious weekend in our culture. Very the sacred gladiator activity is reaching its conclusion, culmination. With the home team here. So thank you for coming in spite of that. Thank you for avoiding that. I'm originally from Wisconsin, so the 49ers beat the Packers a little while back. So I'm actually rooting for the 49ers because I want them to be the best team because they beat my team. Well, there's still time for the game. It's this afternoon, right? So you can do both. Strange culture we live in. Our practice life is a, particularly in this tradition, is always kept in a very, very simple and almost minimal descriptive way. Teachers will just say, just sit down and just follow your breath, or have good posture, see what happens. Particularly in this tradition, there's the sense that the practice is just for itself, just as it is, not for a result, it's not like you do a work and you get a product, so to speak. You're just expressing yourself, in a sense, by this activity. You're just manifesting yourself as someone who's arrived home, so to speak. So very simply, we talk about practice that way. But as everyone knows, that the practice itself has effects. And there are results from the practice. And there are the ways that the practice itself please come. There are ways that the practice manifests, you could say. And one of the fruitions or the attributes of practice that is also an expression of the practice itself is what's called equanimity. This is kind of a topic, a long-standing topic for me, and I've talked about it before. Equanimity is the an attribute that's called the Brahma, one of the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are the Brahma Vihara means the kind of the great or noble attributes or expressions or fruitions of practice. Maitri is one of the Brahma Viharas. Brahma Viharas are also called apramanas in Sanskrit, and apramana means the unmeasurables. So these are These are things that we do or we are or we manifest in our practice that we don't say just so much. We just, they're limitless. And we don't finish them. We don't necessarily finish them. They're basically expressions of our way. So one of the apramanas or the brahmaviharas is maitri, which is basic friendliness, loving friendliness. Another one is karuna, which is compassion. A third one is mudita, which means a joyful response to another person, a sympathetic or loving response to another's how another person or another thing is. In other words, like a good relationship. And the fourth one that's kind of a wrap up of all this is called upeksha, which means equanimity or balance or composure. So these are an expression of kind of the fruition or the enjoyment aspect or the manifestation aspect of practice. With practice itself, it's a deliberate effort. It's a intentional effort to come to the center of our being and to settle into or arrive home at where we are. But the fruition of this is that we develop or we manifest in better relationship with other things, with compassion, with loving kindness, and with sympathetic joy toward others, and with equanimity. So it's this fourth one that I want to talk about a little bit. It's a very important aspect of the Buddhist way. It's said that the Buddha himself, when he was awakened, was in this jhana state, the fourth jhana, the jhana of equanimity. So what do we think about when we say equanimity? I think we all know the word and we have a sense of what equanimity is. Does anyone have a... Can anyone say anything about what they think equanimity is? John? Yeah.
Maybe an even mind, whatever comes in, we just accept and let it go. Not get knocked off
our seat, huh?
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Settled, still.
Still.
Good.
When we think about our lives, we're a mass of... Did you want to say something?
When I think of equanimity, I think of equality and sameness without hierarchy.
Not just hierarchy, but many things, sameness. Mm-hmm. Good. All these aspects are part of work, are part of equanimity. We don't talk about it too much in Zen practice, but there is a kind of an enjoyment aspect. It's in Japanese, I think it's called Jijyu Zamai, joyful samadhi, one-pointedness or meditative absorption. The term upeksha, the Sanskrit term, I'm particularly fond of some Sanskrit terms because they're kind of broader and they contain a bigger sense of meaning than just say one English word. So the word apeksha means, literally, etymology means to look over, to see over, not to just see one aspect of something, but to look over and to see the whole picture, to see how things are. In India, the apeksha is understood as to see with patience or to see with tolerance. We all know that we sustain our being, our individual, exclusive being, with a whole litany of likes and dislikes and preferences. And in a certain sense, that kind of makes a self, that makes who we are. I might because I think so-and-so, and I do this rather than that, and I like the color blue instead of green or something like that. I have preferences. But this sense of apeksha is to see over, to look over, or look in this sense, a kind of, in a broader sense, to see a view, to have a view that is not necessarily excluding those preferences or excluding that tendency, you could say, to move this way, but to also to look over and to see that's just a view, that's just a preference, and that other preferences and other views exist within that view and actually help and sustain that view or that bias. There's another Sanskrit word for upeksha, as well as upeksha, for equanimity. It's called, it's a compound word, it's called tatra manjihat tatta. And tatra means to be there, theirness, it means to be here. And manjihat means the middle. And the tatta, the suffix, the tatta means to stand or to be in place. So it means to stand or to be poised or to be in place in the middle of something. So I think what you said, John, this corresponds to what you said, to see, to actually be in the middle of a circumstance or a situation or a relationship with something or someone. So what do you think? Do you think we can do this work of having a broader view, to look over or to look more comprehensively and to be in the middle? I think it is an aspect of the practice. So the more we practice, the more we soften our particular bias, our particular view of likes and dislikes. Do you know the term, the eight worldly winds? The eight worldly winds. These are like the things that push us around, that the four sets. The worldly winds of praise and blame. And the wind of success and failure. And the winds of what is favorable or pleasurable and what is unfavorable or unpleasurable. And the wind of fame or disrepute. So in classical Buddhist tradition, these are the worldly winds that push us around. They push us this way and they push us that way. We have preferences, obviously, for those things. We want the praise. We want the success. We want the pleasure. We want the fame. And, of course, we don't want those negative aspects. And these winds push us around. And the aspect of equanimity, of coming back to the middle and seeing that within praise there's blame, within light there's darkness, within self there's no self. To see that there's that all our biases are our conditioned states is a kind of arrival at a place of peace, a place of balance. Upeksha, the word upeksha has three basic aspects in traditional Buddhist studies. It has three aspects. One is called samatha. Sama means same. It's the same root as samadhi. Samatha means equilibrium. Things are equalized. There's the various states of one is called laya, which means to actually push something away or to depress something, to subdue it or to dissolve it. And the other one is called ayudatta, and ayudatta means to make things too excited, too energized. So samatha, the aspect of samatha is this sameness of all dharmas, the sameness of all phenomena. We cultivate and we come back to and we remember the sameness of all dharmas. That is, all phenomena, all things, all aspects. They do have distinctions. They do, from our particular point of view, from our limited point of view, they have distinctions. In fact, that's how the world works, by this differentiation. But the fruition of the practice is that with the knowledge and awareness of the distinction of things, of the differentiation of things, we also bring forward this view of the interconnectedness of things. And so they both move together, and that's samatha, samatha. Upeksha is called prasatha, prasatha-ta. And prasatha-ta, the Sanskrit word prasatha, means to flow. Like someone said that about. Was it you saying? No. That there's a flow, or there's a tranquil flow. So that's prasatha-ta, which means the tranquil flow of mind. You actually, the development of upeksha is developing a tranquil flow of mind. So the tranquil flow of mind is not pushed around by these winds, these worldly winds. And the tranquil flow of mind knows in the midst of having a preference or making a distinction, that there's also the other part that is able to see the other side and to find balance in that. Basically, the same as practice. So when we practice, when we sit down and practice and we're aware of our mental state, and we notice our mental state, we're practicing what's called vipassana. We're having insight into our mental state. And then we pacify it. We settle it. That's called shamatha. And then those two things are unified. And that's called tsazen. That's called practice. Shamatha and vipassana. Insight or awareness or presence and settling, pacifying, tranquilizing, letting things be, as I said during practice, how we come to our practice. Those two things together, yoked together, is the way to practice. So the third aspect of this is called anabhogata or anabhoga, and this is another Sanskrit word that means bhoga means to make an effort or to strive. Anabhoga means no striving. So the third aspect of equanimity, of upeksha, is that it is not something that is gained, or it's not an acquisition. It's not something that is strived for. Its manifestation is that it's actually natural. It's a natural state. It's the tranquil flow of mind. It's the sameness of all things, and it's functioning naturally. It's without effort. It has no effort. It has no striving quality to it. Anabhogata, ta at the end means ness. It's striving, it's non-strivingness, or it's effortlessness. It's kind of like, it's not that there's no application, but it's kind of like when we all drive cars, so we know that at a certain point when we were growing up, we had to learn how to drive a car, and we had to make effort to drive that car. And we had to learn the various steps, what to do with the clutch, and how to steer, and pay attention to the road. And at a certain point, there was no effort. We just drove. Our body and mind were unified. Our connection to the vehicle, and we got in the car and we drove. Right? It was effortless. That's anabhogata. That's another aspect of upeksha. So what do you think? Can we all practice equanimity together? Before studying this, I thought of equanimity as basically to be unbiased, to kind of see both sides of things. I saw it more as a kind of mental state. But you can see that this is more than a mental state. It's the actual functioning in the world. So we do, when we do meet another person, or we do meet in an event, or we do have an experience, we come to it with, habitually, we come to it with an assessing mind. We say, I like this, I don't like this. This is favorable, this is unfavorable. This is beneficial to me, this is not beneficial to me. You're wrong, or you're right, or I like you, or I don't like you. We're habituated to come to experiences or to come to a relationship or to meet another person with an assessing mind, which is basically an acquisition mind. But the fruition of the practice encourages us to actually have a, without negating those biases, without negating those preferences, to actually also have a higher view that sees, oh, in the midst of not liking this dessert, say, for instance, there's also one who likes this dessert. Actually, I really like this dessert. And they, you can enjoy the balance between those two things. Not pushed by the winds of preferences. We can see this kind of balance in everything. Reminds me of a story of a Sufi master, I think his name was Nasruddin. Someone asked him, a student came and asked him, tell me how to live. I want to learn how to live. And Nasruddin said, teacher said, just do what's appropriate. And the student said, well, how do I learn to do what's appropriate? And the teacher said, through experience. The student said, how do I gain experience? The teacher said, through doing what's inappropriate. Last week, Doug talked about he talked from a quote from Nagarjuna about emptiness. And by the way, we're going to have a session soon with Angie. I think it starts next week. Is that right? On Friday. And as well as the session itself, it's going to be the opening of a practice period here at Jikoji. So for traditionally in practice centers, particularly the winter time, the rainy season or the winter time, is a time for intensive practice. So Jikoji is going to have a practice period. And that's a time for everyone to do a little more practice and to also to study. And Doug's going to be the practice leader for this session, and he's going to be studying the Diamond Sutra. And Diamond Sutra concerns shunyata, or emptiness. And he read from Nagarjuna, who's an Indian teacher who emphasized shunyata, or emptiness. He had this phrase that says, I salute him, that is, I salute the Buddha. I honor the Buddha. I honor Buddha nature. I honor the Buddha within myself. One who is fully enlightened, one who is fully awake, and who is able to communicate it. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Who preaches or who talks of non-ceasing. So to kind of extend this phrase, this a little bit, in the midst of the world as we know it, that is ceasing, right? There is extinction, there is death, and there is birth. In the midst of this world where there's birth and death, there is this teaching, there is this understanding of non-ceasing and non-arising. There is this equanimous state of, in the midst of birth and death, in the midst, to have this view of non-ceasing and non-arising, of non-annihilation and non-permanence, of non-identity and non-difference, the non-appearance and non-disappearance, and finally, the dependent arising, the appeasement of obsessions, and the auspicious. So that's Nargarjuna. That's speaking of Nargarjuna. So in the midst of this world, which is the world of differentiation, to also carry forward the view of non-differentiation. The teacher Dogen Zenji said, talked of this in a particular way. He said, when the truth has not yet, when truth, or when all the dharmas, or the truth, has not yet filled one's body and mind, that person might feel complete. But when truth has thoroughly filled one's body and mind, they know that something's missing. So what's missing? What would you say? What's missing? From a state of equanimity, what would you say is missing? Well, you could say untruth. When the truth has thoroughly filled your body and mind, when you have this wonderful idealistic view of the truth, and you think you're complete, something, what's missing? When truth has completely filled you, when you really hold and embody the truth, you know something's missing. You know that's not the whole story. Dogen says, again, it's like if you were out in a boat past the view of any mountains, then the expanse of the ocean might appear to be round. But of course, it's not round any more than it's square. Inexpressible virtues, inexpressible, unlimited aspects still remain as ocean. From a certain point of view, it could even be considered to be a palace or a necklace of jewels. But for the moment, from that point of view, there's only the circle of the ocean. Dogen says, aspects of this dusty life, as well as a pure life, are perceived only to the extent that practice and the eye of insight will penetrate. So in our study of things, as well as being round or square, an ocean may manifest in infinite variety. There are worlds in all directions, and there are worlds right here, and worlds even in one drop of water. What do you think? Do you have any questions or would like to say anything?
I don't know, but I'll try. I keep thinking about right effort as part of our practice, right effort. And I wonder, what is this effort, since you push one way and you're off balance. You push another way, you're off balance. So it almost seemed to me that no effort is the right way. But then you talk about those worldly winds. So I guess, you know, if you've grown up when the wind has been coming from one direction, you must be a little bit off kilter, going around.
Everybody leans one way or the other.
The only way to change that, I don't know. It doesn't feel right to make an effort to straighten up against that wind. And let me tell you, I don't know why that just doesn't feel right. So I guess what you do is you keep going until you encounter another wind which blows the other way and blows you back up again, which is called experience. And then it feels effortless. I don't know if it makes any sense, but that's what's going through my mind.
Well, maybe effortlessness in this sense can be seen as more like a natural expression. So we're smarter than we think. We have a breadth and a depth of intelligence. More than we acknowledge and more than we manifest. We know that, in fact, that's why we're here. We know that we're actually acknowledging a very deep request to arrive at the totality of ourselves. And we know that we're more than our views and our biases or our karmic tendencies, leaning this way or that. We know that's not the whole story. And so we have this impetus to practice. Or what did you say? We're something about thinking. We're not what we think. Did you say that?
Different?
Yeah. Very nice statement. Yeah. So that's way mind.
That's
the way seeking mind itself, yeah. There's a request to arrive at the totality of our being. And the equanimity itself, or this kind of balance, or this kind of equipoise, this kind of sense or impetus to come back to the middle, to not lean too far to the left or lean too far to the right, to not lean into our experience, which means to sort of live in the future, or to contract back in, to pull back into the past or into our story of what, how things are. The actual expression of practice is called sitting upright, and it means you don't lean to the left or the right, you don't lean forward or you lean back, you sit upright in the midst of your whole life. And like I said during the talk, you accept your life with each breath. Upeksha itself is our birthright, our natural expression of arriving at the totality of ourselves.
And at that moment of arriving at it, it feels effortless.
Exactly.
And then a moment later,
it
isn't anymore.
Yeah. Just like good posture, when you're holding good posture in sitting, it feels effortless. It feels like you belong there, like you've arrived. But then thoughts come in and your posture kind of collapses. And then you have to build it back up. You have to check and build it back up again.
Yeah, this, what you were doing is, I think, the response that you're after. That is, we don't push against that wind, but we do sit down. I think our practice is, that feels, I've heard many people say, this feels right.
Uh-huh, it's a good.
So you said it didn't feel right to push against it, mm-hmm. but it does feel right to just sit down.
Well, if you sit down, you're definitely not as vulnerable.
You're closer to the ground.
Which is a grounding place to be. And from this place, things can come and go. I mean, when you look at Buddha, this is a very soft posture, but it's very stable. And it's sitting in this empty space, this empty spot where all the winds can come and go, and you're grounded there. So I think our practice is the response to these winds. Mm.
The traditionally, the way it's described is the four jhanas, the four meditative absorptions or knowledges. The first is discursive awareness. In other words, awareness or attention or presence that includes thought, includes mental thought. The second one is non-discursive awareness. You're aware, but thought is no longer necessary. You don't have to sort of check in mentally. And that's the second jhana. The third jhana is non-discursive awareness, nirvikalpa jhana it's called in Sanskrit. Nirvikalpa jhana accompanied by you're actually at a state of fruition. You enjoy it. It's pleasurable. You're really having a good time. You're in samadhi. Your practice is going along. It's taking care of itself, and not only that, you're really enjoying it. But the fourth state, the fourth jhana, is upeksha itself. Is equanimity. It's non-discursive awareness. And this is a state where the Buddha woke up. This is how it's talked about. His awakening came not when he was in a joyful state, but he was past the joyful state, where there's neither sorrow nor joy, neither desire nor aversion. He was completely balanced. So the fourth state was this non-discursive awareness, this presence in perfect balance with everything. That's Upeksha. And that's where the Buddha, that's where the Buddha woke up. So that's encouraging for us.